again, welcome to The Green Front. I am your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and I am very excited to have D.R. Tucker, my favorite Republican climate convert, joining me for this interview with Jill Stein. She is a candidate for president of these United States. She is the Green Party candidate, and I am really looking forward to this interview because so many people have been asking, where's the Green Party in all this? And the Green Party has been very active, but you don't get much coverage, or they don't, from mainstream media. And we're going to give Jill Stein all the coverage that she has time for. She's going to be joining us for at least the first half hour. Perhaps we'll go a little bit longer because there is so much to talk about in terms of the environmental crises that we're facing as a country that you're not hearing about in any of the presidential debates. Starting to hear a little bit from President Obama, but not nearly enough commentary and action and leadership on that front. And of course, there's many other environmental crises. We talk about them here on the show all the time, but here is someone joining us in a moment who's actually working actively to address them. And the Green Party is not just solely focused on environmental issues, although I'm sure that they put them near the top of the agenda, unlike the other candidates. But we're going to find out, first of all, what the Green New Deal is for America, and then some other issues and their position on that. I want to welcome D.R. Tucker to the show. Hey, D.R.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Great to have you on, and I hope Jill Stein is with us now.
You hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Hi, Betsy. Hi, D.R. It's great to be joining you.
Welcome to the show, The Green Front, where we cover the green front lines because there's so much happening that you don't see when you turn on NBC News or even MSNBC or even on current TV. Al Gore's network is now going to talk and format, and we're trying to see if he thinks we need a show focused solely on green issues and climate issues. Stay tuned for that one. But, you know, you think that, you know, we really don't have much to worry about in the ecological sense, and yet, au contraire. So, first of all, thank you for representing the Green Party. Thank you for being a female representing the Green Party. And let's start with a little bit of background about you know, the Green Party and perhaps how you are hopefully rising in the ranks as there are more and more calls from the Occupy Wall Street movement, which, of course, has spread for the need for a third-party presidential candidate, when, in fact, you are the presumptive third-party presidential candidate. So, first of all, congratulations to you for making some headway on that front.
Thank you so much, and I just want to start with a big thank you to you for, you know, for having a program that really is focused on the environment and the climate and these really foundational, important, critical things that can hardly get a word in edgewise out there in the big media. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much for creating this space.
Thank you, and been doing this for about 15 years, just so you know, this is not something that I jumped on the trend on the train for. This is something that seemed to be missing from the news mix as a former radio broadcaster, and I had to fight and still fighting to get equal time for Mother Earth. You know, it shouldn't be so hard.
You're not kidding, and I think it's not only that it's so critical to the future of our planet and our economy, but there is enormous interest on the part of people, and people are clamoring for information, for answers, and for solutions, and there are lots of them out there in droves, and I think it's just wonderful that independent journalists with integrity like yourselves are fighting the good fight at a time when, you know, these solutions are really ready to take off. And, you know, that's very much what the Green Party is all about. We're a relatively new political party that began, I believe, the origins were in the 1970s in Germany, actually in reaction to nuclear power and to promoting solar energy and clean renewable energy as the answer to this very dirty, dangerous, and expensive form of energy. And the Greens have, you know, historically been a little bit ahead of the curve, but the curve has really caught up to them. And the need for that clean renewable energy is just so, you know, incredibly critical right now. The benefits of moving in that direction have really been shown by the great strides forward that Germany has made and the fact that they've really established this new economy and they are prosperous and secure on account of it. So there is a win-win out there that people want to hear about. The Green Party is that new political vehicle that's not funded by Wall Street. It's not funded by big oil and big coal and big nuclear. So we can actually afford to be a voice for the real public interest, public purpose solutions that are really out there. The Green Party has struggled in this country because of some unique things about our political system that make it very hard for anyone outside of the two big political establishment parties to be heard, as you've alluded to. So we've had to really fight our way up through the ranks, but this is a really good time for us to be stepping forward. In many ways, we are at a breaking point on the economy, on jobs, on our health care. Students are up to their eyeballs in debt, you name it. There's a breaking point out there for people and for the planet. We want this election to be a tipping point that can actually get us back on the firm footing that we need to solve these problems, because for every problem out there, there actually is a good, affordable public interest solution, especially on the climate. And one last point here about the Green Party, we put the climate and the economy together because we can't have one without the other. Any economy that ignores its resource base, its environmental base, its water supply, its climate, its sea levels, you know, that's an economy that's not going to be around for very long. You know, it's going to be drowning in floods and storms pretty soon, or in a drought and unable to feed and water itself. So,
as I say, there's no good economy on a bad planet. And I want to let DR jump in here because I'm sure he has lots of good questions and comments. He always does. But you mentioned tipping point, and I think we should take note of the fact that both you and DR are on the East Coast. You're making your way on a campaign tour, I understand. Anyone talking about the weather and how weird it is and how it might be reason for concern as well as something to enjoy this early spring with record-breaking temperatures at least last week in the 80s in Chicago and I guess some parts of the East Coast?
Oh, yes. I mean, for sure. We're seeing 70s. I was traveling through upstate New York last week, and it was hot. I'm in Wisconsin now, which is actually our campaign headquarters here in Madison, and it's a beautiful summer day here, and people are, you know, enjoying it, but at the same time, understanding if it's 70 and 80, you know, in March, what does that mean for August? And more broadly, you know, this just underscores people's fear that our climate has been, what shall we say, you know, really thrown off kilter and is being very irresponsibly mismanaged now. And I include the entire political establishment in that because we have not moved forward. And we see this president, in fact, although he has, you know, he has given some support in his, in his talk, but he hasn't walked a walk, and is now embracing basically what used to be the policies of George Bush. You know, drill, baby, drill, opening up the Arctic, opening up our national parks, our offshore oil. You know, he's embracing the Keystone Pipeline, celebrating its southern half, which doesn't bode well for what comes next. Mm-hmm. He's embraced fracking. And his administration really put a halt to an international accord in Durban in 2020. And this is, you know, this is just an unspeakable tragedy, because to do nothing between now and 2020, basically, you know, as that recent climate conference, I believe in London just this week, you know, came out and said, if we do nothing until 2020, it's kind of game over. So this is the time to move forward. That's why we want to use this election to turn a breaking point into a tipping point, because there are good solutions out there, and we want to put them to work.
And the latest predictions, just very, very quickly, you know, we could, if we do business as usual, see temperatures rise from 5 to 6 degrees this century, which is shocking and much, much faster than earlier reports had predicted. DR, you might have some comments on this.
Dr. Stein, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. I wish I had voted for you in 2002 and 2010, and I apologize for not doing so. Considering the role that big money plays in blocking energy reform and thwarting environmental protection, do you support a constitutional amendment that would effectively nullify the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling?
I certainly support that, and as you may know, many people do. There are many towns and cities and even states that have now called for a constitutional amendment, not only to nullify the Citizens United decision that just, you know, puts money in politics on steroids, but actually which supports a constitutional amendment to clarify that the rights of personhood belong to people and not to corporations, that when you give corporations the right to contribute to elections, to have so-called the freedom of speech, that this is very dangerous to put that much power into these extremely powerful economic vehicles for concentrated wealth, that we need to be clear about what the Constitution establishes. And that enables us as people to actually run a democracy for the benefit of people and not for concentrated economic power. And you're absolutely right. The power of money to buy out elections that we are seeing now, rolling out before our very eyes, I think is really quite dreadful and is really quite a wake-up call that we need to put that Citizens United decision and everything it represents about money controlling our election system, we need to just put it to bed as quickly as possible.
Also, as a physician, do you think the medical community has done enough to point out the threat climate change poses to public health?
That's a really good question, and I have worked very hard with a physicians group called Physicians for Social Responsibility that works very hard to do this. And you know, the same power of big money to basically influence the media, to influence what gets covered, to influence public thinking. That problem, prevails in the realm of elections, and it prevails just in ordinary discourse. And I have been very much a part of this physician and nurses and general healthcare provider group, making the point that human health is extremely on the line here. And in fact, it's not only that we have a lot to lose from climate change, it's also the flip side, that by doing what will stop climate change in its tracks is exactly what we need to do, not only to make our economy healthy, but also to make our health good and put our health back on the firm footing as well.
You would think. So why are we seeing these Republican presidential candidates, men who would lie? By the way, they're always in the same suits. I don't know if you've noticed that. All four of them lined up. They look like, cookie cutters. And if one of them showed, a tenth of the intelligence that you're showing just in the first 15 minutes and, putting together thoughtful comments and addressing the real issues, DR might even consider voting for one of them. He's a former climate skeptic turned climate convert. He is Republican. I don't have to speak for him, but you, DR, can talk certainly about how you moved from a conservative Republican to moderate simply because of the Republicans' denial of climate realities. And we can just get to that in just a quick second. I just want to note, because I'm a news person from way back, what's going on right now as we speak with the Supreme Court ruling on health care. And, because I always see the world through green lenses, we could talk about that all day. That's not the subject of, this show, which is the environment. However, my take on that is, here we go again. And while health care reform is important, it took up, the first 2 years, basically, of Obama's administration, a heck of a lot of bandwidth on all levels. And now, we're going to be losing more precious time if you're looking at, what's going on with the climate urgencies alone.
Exactly. And can I segue off of that to point out that there is, there's some common denominators here. So one of them, is that big money, health insurance money in the case of healthcare, is fighting real public interest solutions that could save us a lot of money. And, I'm not alone as a medical doctor in thinking we could have had a much better solution actually on the healthcare front too that didn't require a mandate, that in fact just expanded Medicare and could offer comprehensive healthcare, restore personal choice, and do it at a huge savings, because 30% of our healthcare dollar right now goes into this massive insurance bureaucracy. So we can do away with that by moving to a Medicare for all system. But that was taken off the table, even by Obama, because the insurance companies were really weighing on him and the pharmaceutical companies were weighing on him. They didn't want to go there because their profits depend on maintaining the system. And they allow you to tweak the system, but not to fundamentally change it. So, we missed the boat. In missing that opportunity to really implement healthcare reform, and now we're seeing the same powers, play out again and really block real healthcare reform that would be affordable and actually save us money. you know, same thing is true for these, you know, environmental solutions, energy solutions that are being blocked by big coal and big oil and big nuclear. The common denominator being, you know, again, as DR was pointing out, this big money and politics thing. But if I can also mention, there's another common denominator, and that is if we do what's right for the planet, we get healthy. And I want to offer up a statistic. That is that about 75% of our healthcare dollars are spent on chronic diseases that are avoidable if we do the right thing up front. You know, so we're talking about things like cancer and diabetes and obesity and heart disease and stroke and all those familiar faces.
That go into the gross domestic product calculation.
Yeah, exactly. Hugely. It's over $2 trillion a year that we're spending on healthcare, but most of it is spent caring for diseases that could have been avoided. Now, how do you avoid them? Well, there are two really important things. Well, let's say three. You know, one is eating a healthy, largely fresh fruit and vegetable diet, plant-based diet. Not entirely. Doesn't mean you have to go vegetarian. But it means a local and sustainable organic food system. People get healthy when they eat it. We know that.
Eat green. Vote green. Eat green.
Exactly. Eat green. And also, you know what else? Travel green. That is, you know, going by bikes and by walking and dovetailing that with public transportation. There are countries that do this, and they are healthy. If you want a society to be active, everybody can't go join a health club and pay big bucks to do it. You need to have exercise that's just sort of built into our transportation system. We call it active transportation. In Copenhagen, 40% of people bike to work. So guess what? If you're eating a healthy diet and you are biking to get to work together with, you know, the bus that can also hold your bike, and you're not breathing the pollution because you've got now a whole lot of people biking or taking public transportation, you're not breathing in that air, which that dirty air that contributes to the epidemic of asthma and heart disease and strokes and all the rest, you know, suddenly you start getting healthy, and then you don't need to be spending all this money. And you're not getting these epidemics that we otherwise have. So this is a win-win. It's a win for the climate, and it's a win for our health. And that also means then it's a win for our budget. Because health care, as you may know, is one of the biggest drivers of national debt and this growing, debt ceiling crisis. So by doing the right thing to avoid climate change, we actually get a huge health dividend that comes back into our pocket as taxpayers.
Very good point. Dr. Stein, you mentioned, you know, big energy blocking policy solutions to the threat of climate change. What's your preferred policy solution? Do you think there should be another crack at cap and trade, or do you prefer the fee and dividend model that Dr. James Hansen has embraced, or what specific solution do you have in mind to reduce emissions?
You know, I think that fee and dividend is much simpler. It's not so administratively complex. There are, as you probably know, a lot of problems with cap and trade that sort of lend itself to creating, you know, another casino around carbon emissions and speculation and all of that. So it's a very complex and kind of risky system, whereas fee and dividend, you know, it's much simpler. It puts a cost on carbon at the source, so it's much easier to put it into practice, and then it provides a dividend back to people, so it doesn't really cost us as taxpayers. That money comes back to us, and we can use it to help move green energy forward. What I would add, though, is that that alone isn't going to do it fast enough. And what we want to do is actually shift the economy, help us make this transition, because the economy is in a rut right now. We're stuck with this really entrenched unemployment problem. Some jobs are coming back, but they're not good jobs. I mean, this is the sort of well-kept secret. The jobs that are coming back are low-wage, poor-benefit jobs, even in the auto industry that's held up as a big, you know, example. The jobs that are coming back basically can't support a family. They're coming back as low-wage jobs. So we're talking about a recovery program that actually puts our dollars to work shifting the economy, making that transition from the old gray fossil fuel economy to the new green economy of the 21st century that's actually secure, that meets our energy needs, and which allows us, by the way, to draw down on all these wars for oil that just keep expanding all over the place. And as your news broadcast mentioned just before this show, we've got the threat of wars for oil, for water on the horizon too. So we need to preempt this incredible war budget that we're already spending and is only going to get bigger by creating this green economy here at home that allows us to meet all of our needs. So what we would do basically, like the New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression, we would use a certain amount of money. It would be on the order of our first stimulus package, actually probably a little bit less than that. But instead of putting a whole lot of money into tax breaks that kind of came and went and didn't really create jobs, this would go into directly creating the jobs that make us more sustainable and ecological for the long run. So it's jobs in clean, renewable energy and weatherization, efficiencies, all the things to get the benefits that Germany is getting right now out of moving to a green economy, the local and organic sustainable food system, public and active transportation, clean manufacturing, as well as the jobs that make us socially sustainable, including teachers and affordable housing and things like that. So we're talking about a nationally funded program that puts money into the hands of communities to decide how they can become more sustainable and what kinds of jobs they need. This is a win for our economy and a win for our environment.
I believe you, and I'm ready to vote for you, Jill, and I don't think that most of the country yet can. What is the actual reality as far as ballot access?
We are getting there, and I would encourage everybody who wants to see us have a green choice on the ballot and a choice that's not already bought and paid for by Wall Street and large corporations, you know, to get involved and to go to my website at jillstein.org. Right now, we are on the ballot on 20 states and counting. So far, we have made every deadline and every requirement. We are very hopeful that we will be able to offer voters a real green choice in the voting booth in November in probably 46 or 48 states. There are some where the playing field is so tilted you can't get there without millions and millions of dollars in your pocket. But we are very on the way. We have ballot access campaigns going on now. We are collecting signatures to be able to meet the requirements in 46 to 48 states. So we are quite confident that we'll get there.
Now, you sound extremely intelligent and practical. In fact, you are so clearly. What's the best you can hope for, or anyone who's part of the Green Party or is really rooting for the Green Party, you know, as a viable option?
You know, I think the best we can hope for is that we are going to turn this breaking point into a tipping point in the course of this election. And remember, all bets are off now because we have this thing called the Internet and Facebook, and what did it do in the Middle East? But, you know, remove some really entrenched dictators that everybody said, oh, no way, no how, you can't possibly do that. But people actually got together and moved things forward. So I wouldn't rule out that we could change the White House into a greenhouse in the course of this election. But whether we actually win the office or simply win back our democracy, I think it's a win either way. Whether we're 2% of the vote or whether we're 52% of the vote, it's a win if we reclaim our voice, that is a real voice of democracy, getting a voice into the election which is not corporate sponsored and not constrained by the big oil industry and big nuclear. It's a win just for us to push these solutions into the public dialogue where they can start getting some traction. And in fact, if you look back over history, that's how women got the vote, that's how slaves were achieved liberation, that's how we got, you know, the right to unions and to a 40-hour week and all that. It came from a social movement on the ground, but also an electoral movement run not by a big party, always started by an independent party that wasn't part of business as usual. And sometimes those little parties became the big parties in the course of doing what people really understood the time was right for, and the clock is ticking. So this is a great time to stand up for the jobs that we need anyhow, and which will also take us into that green, clean, sustainable economy for the 21st century.
Sounds great. DR?
It definitely does sound great. Dr. Stein, as I mentioned before, that you ran for governor in Massachusetts in 2002 and 2010. In your view, are there any lessons that Massachusetts can teach the rest of the country in terms of how to address climate change? Have they really led in terms of confronting this issue?
You know, starting back in, I believe, even in 2002, and certainly in my campaign in 2010, we were talking about green jobs and basically talking about the Green New Deal that would create jobs at the same time we green the economy. And the biggest lesson, I think, that we've learned in Massachusetts wasn't so much in the campaigns, because it was hard, you know, again, to get our voices heard. We were shut out of many of the debates and the coverage and all that. But we did an end run around that. And we actually ran a referendum, a non-binding referendum, but still a real test of the waters. We did this in like 26 cities and towns around Massachusetts. And that referendum basically was the Green New Deal. And it asked people, should we redirect our public dollars, basically these billions that we give in subsidies to the big multinational corporations that are not green, you know, that are you know, promoting more roads and auto transportation and airports. And
the opposite of green.
Exactly. Should we move those, and coal plants and all that, should we move those dollars and put them into local small businesses and cooperatives in the green areas of the economy? We didn't have money to spend on this, so we thought, well, let's hope maybe we could get to, you know, maybe 10% or 15%. But you know what we actually got? I mean, we were blown away by this. It wasn't just sort of progressive, green-thinking communities. It was also burned-out, you know, urban, blighted communities as well. The really poor and jobless communities. This won by 85 to 95% in all communities. People were ready for a solution that both fixes our climate and fixes our economy at the same time. And to me, that was such an eye-opener that people are really ready for what we're talking about. And if I could fast forward to this campaign, we launched this campaign at a public university in the Midwest, actually Western Illinois University. And at the time, we were running 3% in their polls. And a young woman called me up and said, I'm your campaign manager. You need to come here. We're having a mock election. So I said, yes, ma'am, I'm coming. And I did. We launched our road show, our campaign trail at that point. I had 6 minutes to explain not only the Green New Deal, but also our education policy, which includes public higher education that is tuition-free, as it should be, for the 21st century, and forgiving student debt, because we forgave the banks who caused the problem. We can forgive the students who've been the victims of the problem. So I went through that agenda quickly in 6 minutes, and in 6 minutes we came up from 3% to 27%, which in a three-way race, as you may know, that's not far behind a tie or a win. So it took 6 minutes to do that. If we could do that in 6 minutes, you know, I think the sky is the limit, because people see that this economy that is not working for people, that's working for the powerful few, and it's not working for the planet. You know, it's working for the oil companies and the coal and nuclear and fracking and natural gas. You know, this is not working for us, and this is a great time to take it back. One other thing, if I can mention it, when I'm out there on the campaign trail, I hear over and over that, well, gee, this is, you know, this is like miraculous. You know? this is common sense and common good, and what an indictment of our political system that it hasn't really reflected this reality before. So you have to ask, why is it that it's not there? And one thing that I think is really important, that's that many people are afraid to vote their values. We've been told that that would be very dangerous. It might help a candidate you don't want, because we have this crazy voting system where the outcome of the vote depends on how many people are running that represent that point of view. So constituencies can get divided, votes can get divided, all that. There's a better way to do this, I should mention. It's called ranked choice voting. You just rank your choices. So if you want to vote for an underdog as your number one, you do that. And your number two is your safety. So if your number one loses, your vote is reassigned to your number two candidate. There are countries that use this. There are cities and towns around America that use this. We can use this for president. We can use this for governor. We can use this a lot of places. And it totally removes fear.
We just used it in San Francisco from there. It was a little bit confusing, but it was an interesting new option. And I'm wondering, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I have so many questions, and I know DR only has a couple more minutes to stay with us and
okay,
you as well.
Great.
You know, just what about the Ralph Nader effect? You know, what do you tell people who say,
great,
I'd love to vote for you, but I don't want to help elect Mitt Romney?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, we could fix this with a voting system, but, you know, we're not going to have that this time around. So what do you do? And what I point out is that people have been practicing that politics of fear, you know, voting their fears, not their values, for at least the last 10 years, you know, since Nader and the drumbeat began. You can't do that, or you'll get something really bad that will happen. You know, you might get all these bad climate policies. You might get expanding war. You might get an economy that really goes into the doldrums. And what did we get? You know, what we found over the past 10 years is that silence, political silence, is not an effective political strategy. And the politics of fear has delivered all of those results that we were afraid of. The growing, you know, climate crisis, et cetera, the meltdown of the economy and the climate. The politics of fear has delivered everything we were afraid of and supposed to be quiet in order to avoid. But the truth is, democracy doesn't function with silence and fear. Democracy needs voices and values. That's how we drive it forward, and we're going to answer the politics of fear with the politics of courage and stand up for the real solutions that we need. You know, are we going to win this? We may not. You know, the odds are certainly against it. But we know that if you go into the voting booth and you vote for either of the corporate-sponsored candidates and the fossil fuel-sponsored candidates, you're going to get more of those policies. And walking into the voting booth and voting for them gives them a mandate for more of the same. So they need to see that there is resistance to this. And if it's 5%, that's great. If it's 15%, that's even better. And if we all of us who feel this way actually began to vote this way, you know what? In a three-way race, we would win it. Hands down.
I have two more questions, but I want to let DR jump in with anything, any closing thoughts or last questions.
Sure. But before I let you go, I just want to say once again that it's an honor to speak to you, Dr. Stein. But and building on your last question, I do have to ask, you know, I think of that great George Wallace line. Well, George Wallace wasn't a great man by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm going to use his line. Is there really a dime's worth of difference between Obama and Romney?
Well, I will answer that saying that when, you know, I lived under Mitt Romney for 4 years, and when he passed the governor's office on to Deval Patrick, you know, the poster child of progressive Democratic governors, supposedly, there was hardly a wrinkle of difference between them. And I would agree, these are both, you know, fiscal conservatives. They are not climate friendly, either of them. And, you know, at the end of the day, they are both sponsored by all those dimes, you know, coming from the same big industry sponsors. So we're not likely to see much difference between them, and their policies have become perilously close together on the economy, on the climate, on health care, and I think we have everything to gain by standing up for a real, you know, a party that's of, by, and for the people, that's going to move forward real solutions to solve the problems that we're facing.
Okay, Dr. Stein, I have to ask you, about 6 months ago, Roseanne Barr, who I don't think needs any more introduction, gave kind of a long and rambling but somewhat interesting statement outside the White House saying she was going to run for president as, the Green Tea Party. And a lot of people told me about that because I got frustrated when 30 Tea Partiers were elected to Congress last November, none of whom believed in climate change, and I said, we need a Green Tea Party for those of us, as I say, who are steamed that they're playing politics with our planet. Because we're in hot water before we reach the boiling point, we better, you know, steep on the science, et cetera. So where does Roseanne fit into all this?
Well, Roseanne is now running as a Green Party candidate. She, I guess, gave up on the Green Tea Party and decided to throw her hat into the ring. So we have a contested race, but at this point, you know, I, suffice it to say, I'm the presumptive nominee. I have won every convention, primary, and caucus to date by landslide margins of anywhere from 66% up to about 92%. So, you know, the party seems to be pretty clear that it wants a, shall we say, an experienced candidate that has a good deal of expertise on health and climate and the environment and policy and the economy, which is what I've been working on for 10 years. I think people really appreciate Roseanne's pitching in and getting the word out and her credibility as a spokesperson for working women. I think there's a lot of appreciation for her campaign. But when it comes to actually governing, I think people like very much the experience and the solutions that my campaign is bringing to the table.
And, of course, you're serious, and she is too, but she also jokes that she's, you know, a nutcase with her macadamia nut farm, and, you know, there is always a thread of humor going through, which Lord knows we need these days, these dark
days. We sure do.
So my last question, really, just comes down to this. You know, green issues, for whatever reasons, psychological, sociological, cultural, you know, Americans have just been marginalizing, you know, the many environmental challenges we face, not the least of which is climate change right now, even in the face of, you know, extreme weather events. Green media has been shut out of, you know, mainstream platforms. How does it feel, you know, as a green candidate who is addressing the most pressing issues? We haven't even gotten into talking about peak oil and, you know, renewable energy options in any depth to drill down on that, so to speak. But next time we'll have to have you back.
Great.
How does it feel to be marginalized? I mean, isn't it so frustrating, she said, with a little bit of understanding of how that feels, to be on the sidelines when really, if anyone stopped to, you know, read the scientific reports on what's going on, these issues should be front and center in an emergency, urgent kind of way. And yet somehow this keeps happening over and over again, and yet the evidence is stronger than ever that Mother Nature is shouting at us to pay attention.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's not only Green Party candidates that are marginalized, it is people who are being marginalized and locked out of our economy, you know, in a healthcare system that's serving the profiteers and not people who need healthcare, you know, the millions of people who are losing their homes. I think frustration is the name of the game out there, and people are clamoring for a political system that actually represents them on the environment, on jobs, you know, the whole nine yards. And I entered into political discourse after being a frustrated advocate and physician, you know, for 10 or 15 years. And I was recruited to run, and I entered into politics out of desperation. And after my very first race in 2002, I came away with incredible inspiration. Because what you find when you're really out there talking to a lot of people is that we are powerful. We really are the prevailing point of view and vision. You have to get through sort of the loud mouths and the big budgets out there, which are intended to make us think otherwise. But once you get out there and you're talking to everyday people, they are not, you know, they don't consider themselves red or blue. They are people above all who see that strange and weird things are happening to the climate, that we are losing our jobs, that our food is sick, you know, that our health care system is not, you know, it's a sick care system, not a health care system, and that people are going, you know, becoming indentured servants when they try to go to college and come out up to their eyeballs in debt. So people feel like all around them we are at the breaking point. The good news is that there are enough of us out there that we really are the majority on most of these issues, and we have majority support for most of these solutions. The name of the game is building a coalition which works together strategically so we can get to critical mass and force that change. And that change is happening. It has come. You know, it has come to the Middle East in Egypt and Tunisia. It has come to Wisconsin, where a very repressive governor is about to be voted out of office. It is in the Occupy movement that is standing up for a more representative democracy and an economy that works for everyday people. the spirit of democracy and justice is alive and well out there, and justice for our environment and sustainability is a key part of that movement, and we are bringing that all together to be an unstoppable force. And however far we get in the course of this election, we are going to make that a tipping point. And I encourage people to go to my website, go to jillstein.org, join the team, not just as a voter, but as a leader, because we need your leadership everywhere to be leaders in our communities to help push us forward. In the words of Alice Walker, the famous novelist, to paraphrase her, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing they have it to start with. And there's an incredible disinformation campaign out there to try to keep us from knowing how extremely powerful we are. And that, to me, I just find endlessly uplifting and energizing. We're not going to be stopped. The forces that are motivating us are here to stay, and people are waking up and standing up. And this election can be a real tipping point to seize the moment and start taking back this promise of our democracy and the peaceful, just, green future that really is within our reach now.
Thank you so much for inspiring us. That was so well stated. Thank you so much.
I am so inspired by your inspiration and energizing this whole, conversation, and really bringing a level of eloquence and intelligence and thoughtfulness. And we haven't even gotten into, other issues like foreign policy and education. And I'm just suspecting you're equally brilliant and thoughtful on that. So will you come back to the Green Front, perhaps as soon as a few weeks?
Because I would love to.
Election
it's been
ticking.
Great, and I am so grateful for real journalists of integrity like you that I think without you we couldn't do this, but to have people out there of your, intelligence and vision and integrity, that's what's going to save the day.
And I didn't pay her to say that, and no one's paid me to do this work. It's a labor of love for 15 years and counting.
Absolutely.
That's how passionate I am, so I really relate to your passion.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm going to let both my DRs go now, Dr. Jill Stein and DR Tucker, Doctor of Blogging. thank you so much. We could go on, but I did promise I'd let you go after 45 minutes, and we're a little bit
great.
Over.
Thank you so much.
You to get back on the campaign trail and reach as many Americans as you can and go loud, go forth, and greenify.
Thank you. Let's greenify together.
Okay.
Talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you, DR. I think you've got to go too. We're going to switch over if you just thought that was, really refreshing, we're going to go to the opposite of that and going to play you a clip that I talked about last week and promised, thanks to Media Matters. We have it. This is on the Republican presidential candidates who would like to inhabit the White House who are not at all green, the opposite, not even pale green. Actually, the brown and the black, the darkening of green. Talking about Mitt Romney and friends, and we're going to have a little clip right here in just a second of their positions on climate change, not even, many years ago, not even in all cases a few years ago, but in some cases just a matter of, 12 months or so, how they have flip-flopped, and it just have to put this word of editorializing, when people, commentators, pundits, on the cable TV shows talk about Mitt Romney's flip-flops, almost never do they mention the climate change flip-flop, which, given the importance of that singular issue and the threat to the planet, should come first, in terms of, how dare he, and shameful, to change your mind on something that 99% of the world scientists say is real and is, threatening life as we know it and civilization. So here we go. Just take a listen to this. I think you'll recognize these voices, and I think we should play this probably in and out of every show. If I had a show on cable TV, that's what I would do, going to the spots to say, how can anyone seriously consider voting for these Americans?
And also in the State of the Union, you talked about the quote here, the serious challenge of global climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Were you talking about global warming there?
Absolutely. And it's a serious challenge. And one of the things that I am proud of is this administration has done a lot on advancing new technologies that will enable us to do two things, strengthen our economy and at the same time be better stewards of the environment.
I believe that man's activities certainly can be contributing to the issue of global warming, climate change. Here in Alaska, the only Arctic state in our union, of course, we see the effects of climate change more so than any other area with ice pack melting.
Climate change is real. It's happening. I believe human beings are contributing to it. And I think that our party should embrace this as an issue for us.
I think that John McCain's position Is not really very different than most Republicans.
You agree with them on global warming?
The fact is that we have had climate change. Clearly, humans have something to do with it.
I believe that climate change is real.
It's not just a greenhouse gas issue. It's a national security issue. We have an obligation to future generations to take action and fix it.
Now it's time for Congress to act by capping greenhouse gas pollution. If we act now, we can create thousands of new jobs in clean energy industries before our overseas competitors beat us to it. So come on, Congress, let's get moving. Cap greenhouse gas pollution now.
We don't always see eye to eye, do we, Newt?
No, but we do agree our country must take action to address climate change.
We need cleaner forms of energy, and we need them fast.
If enough of us demand action from our leaders, we can spark the innovation we need.
I am no scientist, but I've traveled throughout the world with Senator McCain and others. And seen the effects of a warming planet.
Do you support capping carbon emissions?
I do.
One thing that all of us have a responsibility to do is to recognize that climate change is here.
That we should move towards the most effective possible steps to reduce carbon loading of the atmosphere.
I think the risks of climate change are real, and that you're seeing climate change. I think human activity is contributing to it. I would develop in this country sources of energy which will allow us to be free of foreign oil, but sources also that don't emit CO2.
I've been to Greenland. I've been to the South Pole. I've been to the Arctic. I know it's real. I've been involved in this effort for many years, and we've got to act, and unfortunately, we have not acted either as the federal government or the Congress.
I consider myself a conservationist. I think we ought to have some cap and trade. It worked with acid rain. I think it could work with CO2 emissions. I think we ought to be out there talking about ways to reduce energy consumption and waste. And we ought to declare that we will be oil-free of energy consumption in this country within a decade.
I try to tell conservatives the word conservative ought to imply caution. And you don't have to win 100% the argument that global warming is happening with human interface to say a strategy which minimizes carbon loading of the atmosphere, which would sound like a rational strategy. And if you can find a way to do it that's economically affordable and that has a good quality of life, why wouldn't you do it?
We must put a value on carbon. Until we put a value on carbon, we're never going to be able to get serious about dealing with climate change longer term.
And you just heard clips from current GOP candidates as well as former President Bush and former presidential candidates, Sarah Palin, of course, and John McCain, and current, although barely, GOP candidate Newt Gingrich. Remember that famous ad where he was sitting there on the bench with Nancy Pelosi? You heard that clip, and somehow he, even though he had Catherine Hayhoe, a very respected, highly respected atmospheric scientist, write an entire chapter for his yet-to-come-out book on climate change. He since chopped that out. He not only was a believer, but was a pretty active proponent for climate change reality, and then suddenly said, no, I don't think so. So, you know, can you spell hypocrisy, folks? Actually, I can't. Every time I write it, I get a spell check. But I know hypocrisy when I see it and hear it, and it's just outrageous to me that people who want to, you know, run this country and this country, you know, being a really important not only force in world politics, but also the single greatest per capita contributor to CO2 emissions, to disbelieve, to not even think about leading, but lead us in the opposite direction off the cliff. It's unbelievable in 2012 that this is what we're facing. So along comes someone like Dr. Jill Stein, who we just heard. If you're just joining us, please go to the Progressive Radio Network for the archives as well as my website, thegreenfront.com. It will be posted later today. She is a breath of fresh air, and she is a Green Party candidate. She is serious. She should be taken seriously. I'm going to give her a lot more time on the show, because I think unless people are aware of, you know, the options out there, we're just going to get discouraged. Certainly we have. And with, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement, with what's happened in the Middle East, you know, with 2012 being the apocalyptic year, perhaps, hey, if the world is going to come to an end, that would be the one reason we wouldn't have to worry about climate change going into the future. But assuming that it doesn't happen, we need to make some major changes, and shifts got to happen. So if the shift is hitting the fan, let's consider Dr. Jill Stein as, if not, you know, presidential candidate for this time around, maybe next time, or maybe some for some other office. I mean, it's time for the Green Party to step up, and whether it's the Green Party or the Green Tea Party, the point is our environmental challenges can no longer be sidelined, can no longer be ignored. We do so at our own peril, and it's just time to stop the nonsense. And I say anyone who doesn't want to, put their climate and their planet and their environment first, to not make it a priority, to not fight to protect, you know, and conserve our precious resources, they have no right leading us. They have no right being a legislator. They have no right being, you know, a statesman in any way, shape, or form, or mayor. Just get out of the way. If you don't believe it, fine. Go to your room. Don't try to pretend that you are an intelligent, informed candidate for, you know, the highest office in the land, and close your eyes, close your ears, because it's politically expedient with your ultra-conservative constituents. Just not going to fly. So I think I'll get off my soapbox now. Bid you farewell. Hope you have a great green week ahead. Stay tuned next week for the Green Front. We're going to have my favorite organic architect, Eric Corey Fried, on the show. That's Wednesday, April 4th. And then coming up Wednesday, April 11th, I am very excited about having Dr. Michael Mann, one of the most esteemed climate scientists out there, and the one who got embroiled and meshed, pulled into that pseudo climate gate controversy. He's out with a new book called Climate Wars. He'll be joining us in just a couple of weeks. So tell your friends about the Green Front, so we're not the best kept secret on the internet. Have a great green one in the meantime, and speak up. These issues are important to you and everybody you know and love.